Now, the 2018 Men's World Cup kicked off today with Russia and Saudi Arabia in the opening match. They're two of the 32 nations fans around the world will cheer on or against in the coming weeks.
Meanwhile, the United States men's soccer team won't be among those since they failed to qualify this time around. But there is good news for U.S. soccer fans this week with the announcement that the country, along with Canada and Mexico, they're going to be hosting the 2026 FIFA World Cup.
Our next guest is here for a look at the latest and to share his love of the game. Laurent Dubois is a professor of romance studies and history at Duke University, where he teaches a class, Soccer Politics. His new book is The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. Laurent, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be on with you tonight. Thank you.
Well, in your introduction, you say played in Senegal. Soccer is as completely Senegalese as any other form of local culture. It's absolutely German. It's absolutely Argentinian. It's absolutely Haitian. Above all, absolutely Brazilian. Why does soccer, invented in England, you write, why does it translate so well to so many different cultures?
Well, this is part of the mystery at the heart of the game, I think, and a fascinating one at that. And it is what makes the World Cup the spectacle it is, that this is rooted in so many places and it's kind of indigenous to so many places. People have an amazing capacity to make this game their own, to make it feel like part of their culture, the way their players move, the way their players play, but also the stories people tell around the game are all very much local. And at the same time, they're very global in scope and shared across these huge distances.
And part of why you say it travels so well is that all you need is a ball, and you share some stories where, you know, there are kids around the country, they don't even need that to play the game.
Yeah, I mean, there's this, you know, it's a very easy game to play, right? And if you go around the world, you'll see soccer pitches or improvised soccer pitches really all over the place. People make balls out of all kinds of found objects. And again, yeah, I mentioned this moving scene in a film called Timbuktu by Abderrahmane Sissoko, where a group of Islamists take away a ball, but the boys still play. They can basically play the game because they already understand the kind of ballet and the movement of the game fundamentally, even without the ball.
And there's one country that's a holdout. People have said that soccer's been the American game of the future for about 50 years now. Why? It seems like it's growing in popularity. I've been taken into the game by my kids, but it's still not what it is here, not what it is around the world here in the United States. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, the quip comes from Eduardo Galeano, actually, who says in his books, Soccer and Sun and Shadow, you know, soccer is the sport of future and always will be in the United States. I mean, it's a very contradictory and interesting question. It's the sport that is played recreationally the most in this country, right? So there's a vast number of people who play the sport, women and men. Obviously, this is a country where the women's game is extremely strong. We've won 3 World Cups, and women's soccer is really on the rise here. So it's all over the place, and yet it doesn't have the space, the place in the sports media landscape or in the collegiate sports landscape that, of course, the big sports like basketball and football do. It is actually among people under the age of 35 now has surpassed baseball as the third most popular sport, according to local recent polls. But there is also this kind of persistent sense that it's somehow not quite American, right? That it's sort of an odd sport, not quite our sport, our national sport. And I think that's very interesting. And that comes up, of course, during the period of the World Cup.
And you talk about all the things to love about the game, the beauty, the international appeal. But in some cases, we like the game in spite of some things. FIFA, the organization itself, and corruption, the bleed through of politics, the game being hosted in places like Russia or Qatar with very thin connections to democratic participation. We love the game. People love the game despite the warts.
Well, absolutely. I mean, something that is this powerful, right? Soccer is so powerful. I think is undoubtedly always going to attract the powerful. It's going to attract money. It's going to attract those in political power who want to use it and twist it to their own ends. And that has been a feature of World Cups since the 1930s, when Mussolini hosted a World Cup that was destined, you know, that was meant to really sort of support his regime and support Italian fascism. So there's a long history of that. And then at the same time, of course, the sport pushes back in the other direction. The teams are, of course, made up usually very often of people who come from the margins of the societies where they grew up. So they're these kind of representatives of the country, but that look very different often in their backgrounds and in the way they are than, say, the political leaders in their country. So you do have that as well. And then the game also just invites people to make allegiances across national boundaries. Most people are like citizens of the United States this year. They can't root for their own team in the World Cup. There's only 32 countries represented. So in a sense, we're like a lot of the rest of the world, and that means you have to choose a team. And that's an interesting process as well.
Talking to Laurent Dubois, author of The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. Well, let's look at this World Cup field. Can you give advice on people picking a team? I think reading your book, I know your pick. It's France. Do I have that right?
Yes, I'm a longtime fan of the French team and also a fan of the Belgian team. I'm actually was born in Belgium and I grew up in the U.S., but my family's from Belgium. So those are two favorites of mine, along with Senegal, which I think is a really exciting African team.
Well, my daughters daughters have filled out their brackets. One's got Germany going all the way. One's got Belgium. For someone who wants to watch the game and pick a side and hope for them win or lose, how can we Americans evaluate who's out there and get on a side?
Well, there's so many different reasons to pick a team, right? I mean, Germany is obviously always a favorite. They're an incredible team. They've got a great history. So is Brazil. You know, Italy, which is the other powerhouse team people often root for, is not there this year. So it just gives you a sense of how up and down soccer can be. But I think others would like to pick a team where they like some of the personalities of the player or maybe underdogs to root for. I think a lot of people are really excited this year about Egypt because of their sort of lead striker, Mohamed Salah, who's become a kind of phenomenon around the world. A team like France or a team like Belgium is also interesting because you have players of really diverse backgrounds, a lot of players of immigrant backgrounds. Then there's teams like Iceland, you know, that are the real surprises at the tournament, at least a really small country that has this kind of powerful team, and that's always fun to root for. As you saw, I sort of have three teams. I think choosing a couple is a good idea. But also, I think people should watch and decide who they love, how they like the team. That's what they're watching. They like the way they play. Many people in the U.S. will also be following professional soccer, and they may have a favorite player that they follow on their team, and they can follow that into the tournament as well.
In the heart of your book, you go position by position in different chapters and talk about the role of different players. Let's talk about the keeper. That's that standout role where you get to hang out and do nothing for a lot of the game in some ways, and then you get the credit or the blame in that one key moment.
Absolutely. Yeah, I start with the goalkeeper. And really, the book is meant to kind of introduce people to the language, to the architecture of the game, the rules and how to watch it to sort of in a way to get maximum pleasure out of it, because I do think it's a sport that can bring people a lot of pleasure to watch and to play, of course. The goalkeeper is this very kind of outlier figure, obviously the one player who can use their hands in a sport that otherwise you cannot, a player who's sort of contained largely in the penalty box, which is a very large area. It's actually about as big as a basketball court, but still smaller than the field where the other players run around. And also, of course, has this very visible role and, you know, sort of the last person before the ball goes into the net. And so there's a kind of tragic nature, I think, to being a goalie, you know, knowing that no matter what you do, maybe, you know, sometimes a ball will get passed. And I write about figures like Vladimir Nabokov and Albert Camus and other intellectuals who, as they were growing up, were playing as goalkeepers and kind of muse about whether that affected their larger life and perspective.
It's this existential position in sports.
There is, right? There's a kind of an acceptance, you know, and I start that actually chapter with a letter that Gianluigi Buffon, who's this Italian goalkeeper, one of the greatest, you know, we've seen, who wrote a kind of love letter to his goal, which is full of kind of humor and pathos as well. It's a very interesting position, and I think, you know, at the root of the team and fundamental to it, but always a bit of an outsider as well.
We're talking to Laurent Dubois, author of The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our conversation about soccer. Do you have questions about the game? Fans, who are you rooting for in this 2018 FIFA World Cup? Are you excited that the 2026 Cup is going to come to North America? What do you love about the sport? You can call in now with your thoughts, your comments, and your questions at 800-642-1234. You can also share your thoughts by tweeting at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Chris Molina. We're continuing our exploration of soccer's role in global culture as the 2018 World Cup kicks off today in Russia. Laurent Dubois stays with us as our guide. He's the author of the book, The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. He also teaches a soccer politics class at Duke University.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Will you be watching the World Cup? Is there a team you're pulling for? What got you into the game? Is it something you've been into since being a kid, or maybe your kids, as mine did, brought you into it? Or do you have questions? You're maybe a casual fan, want to know a little more? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To our callers we go. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I guess what I like about soccer is there's so many different styles that different countries play, and it's like any sport. The more you know about it, the more interesting it becomes, and the strategies and all that sort of stuff. My father was a goalie in a semi-professional team in the Netherlands, so I always root for the Netherlands. Unfortunately, they didn't make it into the tournament, so I'm rooting for Iceland because they're a long shot, and they're such a small country. Like the Netherlands, mm-hmm. they're a small country. So the other thing about soccer I think that's interesting is that it doesn't demand a certain body type. I mean, you have mm-hmm. to be a good athlete, but you don't have to be tall or, you know, like football or basketball. Anyone can play, and it's a great game. I love watching it. I'm excited that it's time for the World Cup. I'm disappointed that the Netherlands didn't make it into the tournament, but it's a truly a world, a world event, not just a, you know, one particular country.
Willem, thanks a lot. A lot there, Laurent. You write about the body type, and there, you know, some huge stars. People looked at them when they were young and thought, this is not an athlete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely a vital point and really one of the kind of democratic aspects of the game, right? There are a lot of players who, when they were growing up, they were told, you know, they could never make it. Maradona was told he was too short to succeed as a professional. Lionel Messi is also quite short. And of course, it's also been a sport that have been played by women through its whole history. And that's one of the things I really emphasize in the book as well, is that this has crossed gender lines and has been a really important sport for women throughout, although their participation has been constrained at different times by the federations. But I also think that's true. There's a kind of invitation that comes from that, because when you watch athletes, you know, who look a little bit more like you, or you can imagine being in their shoes, that does make a kind of connection between the fan and the athlete, and the connection between playing and watching is important.
Willem, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Laurent, let's talk a little more about the women's game. As you say and as you write, it's been around forever. It has really not always gotten a lot of love from the official organization, FIFA, right?
Well, far from it. I mean, in fact, what I write about in the book is that it was really popular in early 20th century England, and then the English Football Federation actually banned the women's game, essentially told women they couldn't play in the stadia and on the pitches that they oversaw. Obviously, they couldn't stop women from playing entirely, but they excluded them from the official game, and that set back the sport significantly, and there were similar bans in other places. So that's, I think, a really key thing for people to understand, is that it was held back. And now, obviously, we're in a different phase where it's growing again, but the inequalities still persist as a result of having been held back earlier in the 20th century.
One of the most confusing things for a lot of people, I'll include myself in this, in trying to understand the game, is the offsides rule. Mm-hmm. I think I don't know that I could explain it in words, but now I think I can spot it accurately 75% of the time when I'm watching mm-hmm. a game. And that rule has changed over the years.
It has evolved over the years, and I one of the goals I set in writing this book was trying to, hopefully I do, explain the offside rule so that people will fully understand it, because it is really the core architecture of the game.
Yeah.
I mean, it shapes everything about the game, and if you don't get it, it's hard to sort of watch games and understand what's going on. It's also a very, very important and useful rule that I think is fundamental to the kind of flow and the motion of the game. If you didn't have it, I think you would have a game that was far less interesting, but it did evolve over time. The numbers of players and so forth. So I kind of detail that. And I find I'm a historian. I think that when you understand the history of something, it often kind of elucidates a lot better, you know, why it is what it is. And so that's one of the contributions I tried to make in that chapter on the defender.
Let's take another call now. Maria is with us in Holman. Maria, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I just flipped on the radio and was listening to, about soccer and very intrigued. And I'm home for the summer. I'm working overseas in Doha, Qatar, and we're going to be hosting the 2022 games. So it's just been really fun for me to come from the States and go to all these soccer tournaments and watch the games happen and all the excitement and the rivalries and the allies and just see the country, like, getting set up for it, like mm-hmm. building everything and the infrastructure. So it's a very fun sport to go watch. I've never watched soccer when I lived here in the United States. So it's a very fun game to watch.
Maria, thank you so much for sharing that. And Laurent, you write in the book about seeing a lot of games live. Can you share, just in our last minute and a half or so, some of your best moments seeing soccer in person?
Well, some of them have come. I did go to the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. I was at the final then and saw also a very painful game, Ghana-Uruguay, where Ghana lost, which I was rooting for. But those were pretty extraordinary moments. There is a way in which being there, you know, you really feel kind of at the center of the world in a way and being part of those crowds. But I've also been attending Carolina Courage, which is the National Women's Soccer League team here in Cary, nearby in Durham. And those are wonderful games, you know, smaller crowds, but just the dynamism of the crowd and the players and the connection there is something pretty miraculous. And when the game begins, I just think, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. And I love to sort of be surprised. And you always are surprised and taken by what transpires on the pitch.
And we've got this World Cup starting today in Russia, again, 8 years from now in the U.S., Canada and Mexico. Are you kind of trying to clear your calendar for 8 years hence to make sure you have room to catch some of the games while they're on this continent?
Well, I actually always clear my calendar for the World Cup, or both the Men's and Women's World Cup, which makes for some luckily I'm not teaching in the summer, but it's true that that's going to be really interesting. And it means that the next 8 years are also a time of really thinking about soccer in this country and the connections with Canadian and Mexican soccer. So I think it's a big opportunity. It also poses a lot of challenges and questions, and there'll be a lot of debates as well about how the tournaments run and those sorts of questions. But it's going to be a massive tournament, both geographically. It's going to be the largest geographical spread of a tournament ever, and also in size, because they're increasing the number to 48 teams. So this is going to be kind of a huge thing after the Russia and Qatar car tournaments, and there's going to be a lot to do to get ready for it.
Laurent, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Laurent Dubois is a professor of romance studies and history at Duke University. He's the author of the new book, The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. The 2018 FIFA World Cup continues for about the next month.